Hello and welcome to The Lockdown, your usually fortnightly Navarra Media podcast all about prisons and the criminal justice system in the UK. I am your resident rookie still, Sam Swan, at Sam G Swan on Twitter, and I'm joined as always by my co-host.
Una Ryder, hi.
Hey, I left that thing to say.
Thanks. Now I feel like I'm saying hi to myself, yeah. But that's fine. Yep, I'm Una Ryder. I'm at Unski on Twitter. I am, in theory, the resident expert.
And
although
in practice.
Sneakily always have guests on, so I don't actually have to play that role. This is our second episode in the run-up to the United Families and Friends campaign conference. So you might notice that we haven't left a fortnightly gap. As usual, we're back after 7 days with a new episode about deaths in custody. So last week we put out an episode with Marcia Rigg, who is the sister of Sean Rigg, who died at Brixton Police Station in 2008. It's a really amazing, awful and extraordinary story. So I'd urge you to go back and have a listen to that if you haven't yet. And this week we have Deborah Coles from the charity Inquest. Hi, Deborah.
Hi.
We talked a lot about Inquest in the interview with Marcia, so it's really exciting to have Deborah here today. Just a reminder that this is all in the run-up to the United Families and Friends campaign, UFFC, conference on the 26th of October. It's a Friday. The event is free to attend. You can still sign up at Eventbrite and learn more about the issue of deaths in state custody and the amazing family campaigns that have been built around that. And then also on the 27th of October, there is a UFFC procession meeting at 12 p.m. at Trafalgar Square. Sam and I will both be there,
yeah.
As will various people from Inquest.
Indeed, yeah. And it's a particularly important one because it's the 20th anniversary of UFFC. So we hope to have lots of people attending.
Yeah, so please do come and say hi.
Definitely. So Deborah Coles is the executive director of the charity Inquest. Inquest is the only charity providing expertise on state-related deaths for bereaved people, for lawyers, advice and support agencies, for the media and parliamentarians. The organisation supports family members and friends of people who have died in state custody, as well as campaigning for accountability and systemic change in relation to state-related deaths. Deborah has been an independent expert advisor to numerous government committees and inquiries and is the author of numerous articles and publications, as well as being a trustee to two other charities working with women in the criminal justice system. Thank you for coming, Deborah. It's brilliant to have you here.
Yeah, thank you so much. So yeah, Inquest deals with deaths in police custody, prisons and psychiatric settings. But I just wonder if you could give us kind of idea of the scale of the problem. So how many deaths are you seeing in these circumstances at the moment?
The problem is a truly horrendous one. It's difficult because each death represents a personal tragedy for the families concerned. Not all deaths are preventable, but Inquest works on a disturbing number where there are serious questions about failings in care. And what we need to remember is that these are people who've died in the custody and care of the state, where there is an obligation on the part of the prison or mental health setting or police custody. There is a duty to keep that person safe. And the figures have increased at alarming levels over the last number of years. 2016, we saw the highest ever number of self-inflicted deaths in prison, with 95 prisoners taking their own life. And figures still remain at historically high levels. In the context of police deaths, the last reporting period, which is 2017-18, saw the highest number of people die in police custody or following police contact. And last week, figures came out about self-inflicted deaths in mental health settings and found that 106 people had taken their own lives. So these are figures of particularly high scales, particularly when you consider that these are people who are detained in state institutions where there is clearly a duty of care to keep them safe.
These deaths occur in a kind of range of settings and circumstances. Are there continuities in terms of like how and why they happen? Like we were speaking to Marcia last week about the circumstances of Sean Rigg's death and the kind of failure of the state to provide any kind of care, where the state was called because of his mental health issues and then was ended up being put into the kind of prone restraint position and subsequently killed. And so, yeah, is there a continuity there of like why and how people are dying in this kind of way?
I think it's interesting you mention restraint-related deaths involving the police, because these have been some of the most high-profile and most contentious. An inquest has worked on a disturbing number of cases involving deaths of particularly young black men who've come into contact with the police, have been in crisis and have died because of the excessive and unlawful force used against them. And very worrying, the figures of deaths following police contact that came out recently showed that a disproportionate number of black men are still dying following the use of force. So this does point to a systemic problem. And it's a problem not just about accountability and whether or not people are being held to account when deaths like this occur, but it's about how the state learns, or importantly, how the state fails to learn to ensure the systemic change to prevent deaths happening in the future. And I've seen far too many deaths of people who die who are in mental health crisis, who should never have ended up with the police in the first place. And it does raise broader, of course, broader questions about mental health and policing, and which is why inquest work, I think, is important, because what we try and do is we situate deaths in their broader social and political context. So, you know, when looking at a death like Sean's, it points to failings both of mental health services and of the police. You know, his mental health deteriorated, and rather than getting emergency mental health care and support, he ends up in contact with the police. He's restrained excessively and dies as a direct result. And many of the families that we work with, of course, say that their loved one has not died because of their mental ill health. They've died because of the dangerous and inappropriate use of force from police officers. And there is no doubt that there has been a failing to ensure that there have been changes to police training and culture to prevent deaths like this happening. And we've seen it just in the last year, the death of Kevin Clark in South London, another black man in a mental health crisis who is restrained and died. So these problems are continuing. And I think they continue, one, because of the absence of accountability and sanctions against police and mental health services, both at an individual, but importantly at a corporate level, but also because of the lack of proper mental health services in the community, and in particular around mental health support that is culturally specific. So, you know, there is an issue about trust and confidence in mental health services by black people because of negative experiences they've had, and perceptions about the over-medication of people in mental health detention. And of course, you know, mental health settings, we've also seen deaths following restraint, the very well-documented death of Olusheni Lewis, who died when mental health staff called in the police to deal with a man who was in crisis, and then he was restrained to his death. The most shocking case. And
by 11 officers as well, wasn't it?
11 officers, handcuffed, held down. It is one of the most distressing cases. And I think, you know, what these families have done in trying to stop this happening in the future, it is amazing at a time when, of course, they're also grieving.
And
when their lives have been torn apart, but their motivation has always been to try and stop this happening again. So the case of Shaney Lewis has seen because of that family's determination and working closely with their MP, Steve Reed, there is now a bill going through Parliament called the Use of Force Bill, which we've called Cheney's Law. It's his legacy. And that is to try and monitor restraint in mental health settings, because we know from the limited figures that are available that Black people are disproportionately more likely to be restrained, as indeed are women. And Inquest is particularly concerned about the impact of restraint on people who are unwell. And of course, the ever-present risk of death and serious injury.
So that would be about monitoring it in order to bring about accountability, because obviously it's already, like you were mentioning before, there's already unlawful practices by the police in particular.
I mean, I think one important development that I think has been in direct response to a lot of the campaigning of families and Inquest and an important review that was conducted by Dame Ailish Angelini, one of the important things that's come out of that is the police now have a video called 60 Seconds to Save a Life. And that is basically sending out the message to police officers that any form of restraint is potentially dangerous, particularly if it's sustained for a long period. And what we're very keen to see, and I think this is about police culture and training, because some figures came out last week by the Metropolitan Police. So this is the police's own monitoring that showed that use of force had gone up by 79%, and 39% of those who have force used against them are from the Black community. So, of course, yet again, that raises questions about the over-policing and criminalisation of Black people. But also, for me, it begs really important questions about how do we affect learning and change, and points to the need for there to be a change in police culture. And I think a lot of the problems we have about restraint-related deaths is perceptions that the police have about certain groups of people. So, you know, the racial profiling of Black men as being inherently violent and criminal, the stereotypes about people with mental ill health, the idea of mad, bad and dangerous, and how those assumptions and prejudices, if they get embedded into policing culture, can lead to death and serious injury. And my concern about all these figures and about the systemic problem that we see about restraint-related deaths is that there is the ever-present risk of death and serious injury, and there will be until there is root and branch system change.
You mentioned women earlier, and I wanted to talk about a report that Inquest published earlier this year called Still Dying on the Inside. It was in response to a rise in the self-inflicted deaths of women in prison in recent years. And sadly, following that report in early September, it was reported that three women had died in prisons in England and Wales over just a 10-day period. But I wanted to bring it up because most people who die in prison are men. So I was wondering why Inquest chose to put a focus on the deaths of women.
Well, this has been a thematic area of concern for Inquest really since we were set up nearly 40 years ago. And it's been a particular area of interest and concern for me, because I'm also involved with the charity Women in Prison and Clean Break Theatre Company, an all-women theatre organisation. And the issue about women is, I think, particularly significant, because whilst they represent probably around 4.5% of the prison population, they are disproportionately overrepresented. Women in prison are some of the most marginalised and disadvantaged in society, with some of the most complex stories of experiences of trauma, domestic violence, abuse, trafficking, racism, particularly very often victims as well as defendants who end up in a criminal justice system that can't keep them safe. And the reason why we focused on this report most recently is that Inquest were involved with the first review of women in the criminal justice system by Baroness Jean Causton back in 2007. And that was in direct response to campaigning by Inquest and families of women who died in prison, in particular, six women who died in Stahl prison in a 12-month period. And those deaths really, I think, raised both public and political awareness as to the failings of the prison system in dealing with women who often had mental ill health, problem with addictions, who were put into a system that simply couldn't keep them safe. And there was a very prominent family member, campaigner, Pauline Campbell, who used to protest every time there was a death of a woman in prison. She would protest outside the prison gate. She'd try and prevent vans from bringing women in.
She was the mother of a woman who died in prison.
She was the mother of Sarah Campbell, who died in Stahl prison, a death that the inquest found serious, that she'd been seriously neglected, and in fact that her human rights had been breached. Mm. And she was a persistent campaigner who used to harangue parliamentarians at every opportunity she could, and saw the setting up of the Causton Review, and I was on the reference group to that, and we really saw that as a potential kind of blueprint for change. She recommended that women's prisons should be dismantled, that there should be more therapeutic, small custodial settings for the very small number of women who might need to be detained, either for their own safety or for public safety. Mm-hmm. And she recommended a network of women's centres. Now, the response of the then Labour government was to reject the key recommendation about dismantling the women's prison estate, which I believe it was a real missed opportunity. And what it meant was inevitably that the more reformist agenda would be pursued. And whilst there was welcome funding of some women's centres, there was no structural change. And so today we see the same amount of women being imprisoned as we did back in 2007. And I think most concerning is the fact that 2016 saw the highest number of women dying in prison than any previous year.
Wow.
And so we thought that we should do another report that brought together some of the stories of the women who died. And also we wanted to reframe the discussion and looking at prison as a form of violence against women, about the structural violence, neglect that often propels women to take their own lives or to die prematurely. I mean, it's not just a concern that we have about deaths in prison for men and women. It's not just about prison suicide. It's also about the number of premature deaths, people dying at very early ages, often where there are concerns about the quality of the healthcare provided. So we brought out this report, and as well as trying to humanise the stories of those who died, we wanted to raise parliamentary attention to the fact that we're still using prison as a dumping ground for women who could far better be dealt with in the community, because so many of the women who end up in prison are there because of poverty and inequality. Mm. They're there because of failings in mental health services or services for addictions. They're there. I mean, there are seven women in prison today for non-payment of TV license.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an absolutely absurd use of public funds to continue to imprison women. Many women in prison are mothers, so it means that children either end up in the care system or end up being looked after by other family members, which at great personal cost to them, but also to women in prison who are very often sent to prison for very short sentences, but for short enough periods to potentially lose a job, their housing, their child.
Yeah.
So we felt this was an important issue to raise. But also, I think it's also looking at the intersections of, you know, class. I've talked about gender, but race, disability and how that impacts on somebody's experience of imprisonment or detention.
Mm. I want to dig in actually to the racism question a little bit further. I know you've talked about it quite a bit, but we're kind of well aware in this country of the way that police killings and deaths in custody have been a kind of galvanizing issue for racial justice movements in the US. So with Black Lives Matter, you have a really strong analysis on this and have kind of galvanized popular resistance to state violence. There are lots of activists and communities doing this work in this country, but it seems to me the understanding of the relationship between racism and state-related deaths is much less developed on the left in Britain. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about this relationship and what significance you think that this should hold for people who are already engaged in social justice work.
Well, I think it's interesting because if you look at the biggest disturbances that have taken place in this country over the last 30 plus years, they have been responses to black deaths in custody. The most recent being after the shooting by police of Mark Duggan. Mm. Yeah. And I think this is an issue that is well understood by the black community. And I think it connects with their experience of over-policing and criminalisation. And the fears that a lot of young black people have about their interaction with police when they know that there have been deaths as a direct result of police treatment. So I think it's very much perhaps more of an issue for the left and in particular, you know, white people to mm-hmm. better understand the issue of systemic racism, state violence and state racism, which we see in our work, both in terms of policing, but another area that, you know, we haven't discussed is the issue of immigration detention, and the fact that, you know, deaths and serious self-harm and suicide attempts are a regular occurrence within the closed walls of immigration detention centres. We also saw the death of Jimmy Mbenga, who was killed whilst being deported by G4S staff, and the hostile environment in which we're currently seeing premature deaths of people affected by Windrush. So I think when we talk about systemic racism, it's important to look at how it impacts on all forms of kind of imprisonment, detention, because that is the daily experience of a lot of people's lives. And of course, you know, it can be indirect, but also direct. Now, some of the narratives around people who die, I think, are important to consider here, because the experience of racism that a lot of families have in terms of the circumstances of their loved one's death is one thing. But then, of course, that extends to the sphere of the media, so that when somebody dies, there are attempts to demonise the individual who's died. You know, the stereotype of the kind of the gangster, the drug addict, the mentally ill, to try and deflect attention from the culpability of the state and its agents. And I think that narrative, when it seeps into kind of public consciousness, can be really very damaging. So, you know, what we feel at Inquest is that it's really important in our work that obviously we give and you know, families are absolutely integral to our model of working, and we give families a voice where we can. But also in our own work, we try and speak what we would call truth to power in ensuring that we're addressing some of those negative narratives, that, you know, we're placing the evidence out there for people to consider and ask some very important questions about the kind of society that we live in, and also the importance of the democratic accountability of state institutions, and that issues around disproportionality, questions about institutional racism and state racism are actually discussed. Because one of the problems I think that has been since the McPherson report that happened after the death of Stephen Lawrence, where there was a recognition that the police were institutionally racist. Mm-hmm. I think that the language around race has become quite diluted. So we don't talk about racism and discrimination anymore. We talk about unconscious bias. Yeah. We talk about equality and diversity training. And I think it's quite important to name it because, you know, there is no other explanation for the issues that we see in our work other than state racism. And that's an issue that we need to actually address. And indeed, it always concerns me that whenever I use social media to discuss any of the issues, the backlash that I get from police officers or people who describe themselves as pro-police is a really quite violent and aggressive one.
I found there's a real rush to individualise things, often on social media, but also in face-to-face conversations in life, is the urge is for people to say, well, that individual isn't racist. You can't say that this person's a bad person, they're just doing their job. And it's kind of, it's almost beside the point. I mean, it's not in all cases beside the point, but in many cases it is beside the point because it's the context, the system.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think for Inquest, it is about looking at this in a much broader context. It's not a question about a few, you know, bad apples, as people like to suggest. It's about systemic. It's a systemic problem that we see. And that's why I think it needs a much broader discussion and debate. And, you know, when we were involved in the Angelini review, and I'll just mention a little bit about the review, because I think it absolutely reflects the impact of families' campaigns and the relentless campaigning, particularly of Marcia Rigg and RG and Conrad Lewis, because they were determined to hold the government to account for the fact that they had been put through very protracted legal processes at great physical and psychological impact for them, but that they'd found it increasingly difficult to accept a system that had not delivered them the truth and justice and accountability that they deserved and, importantly, that they were entitled to. And the review was set up in direct response to those concerns and at a meeting we all attended with the then Home Secretary, Theresa May. And the review, I think, contains some extremely important recommendations that, if implemented, could help families who are starting the whole process after a death. And if they're implemented, I would also hope that they would lead to less deaths taking place because they acknowledged, and the review acknowledges, the disproportionality of deaths. It acknowledges problems with the whole investigation and inquest process, the process of accountability, but also it talks about the need to have a proper debate around alternatives to custody for people in mental health crisis, to divert people from the criminal justice system in the first place. And it offers, I think, a really good blueprint for policy and practice change. And we're seeing some of those recommendations being taken very seriously by government. Legal aid for inquests, I'm very much hoping that we will end up in a situation where no family will have to go through those protracted legal aid applications, not least when you see that the state has money from the public purse to fund teams of lawyers to represent its interests and very often uses the inquest as a reputation kind of management exercise and tries to narrow down the opportunity to have a proper open scrutiny of what's happened and ultimately to try and shine a light on any system problems and failings in practice to try and prevent deaths in the future, which of course is the family's main motivation for going through the process. I mean, Marcia Rigg has always been very clear. She wants individuals to be held to account, but she wants to try and stop this happening to other people. And her work has directly resulted in changes to mental health, greater awareness about, you know, mental ill health. You know, it's led to some very significant changes, and that's what families want. But there is still an appalling accountability gap, both in terms of holding people to account at an individual or state level. There's never been a successful prosecution for murder or manslaughter of any state servant, be that a prison or police officer, despite a disturbing number of cases where I think there should have been a prosecution.
There never has.
There never has. There have been prosecutions, a couple of prosecutions, but they've failed. But that's a very stark figure when you consider it. Mm. When you think about the thousands of deaths that happened over the last, 30 something years. But also, it doesn't just stop there. There is no national oversight mechanism of recommendations that come out of investigations and inquests. Mm. So there's no monitoring, there's no proper follow-up as to action that has been taken. And one of the most, I think, disheartening aspects of our work at Inquest is to see the same issues being repeated time and again across the kind of prison, police, mental health settings. And that is about accountability. You know, who is accountable for making sure that where recommendations are made, they're actually acted upon? Because that is what we all need. And that's in the public interest because, it's about safeguarding lives in the future. It's about, actually making sure that the same failings do not happen again.
Mm. Well, that's something Marcia spoke about, wasn't it? That there have been so many reviews now and there have been so many recommendations. The work has been done. So what happens next?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of the Angelini review, Inquest are going to work very hard to try and make sure that action is taken in response to the recommendations, and not just the easier ones for government. Actually, government could change the legal aid situation overnight if they wanted to. It's about political will. But, it's also about ensuring that there is proper accountability when people die, and that there is a system whereby people are held to account when they fail or when they use, excessive force against individuals. Mm. A healthy democracy is one in which, you are called to account for unlawful violence or indeed, issues around neglect. And I mean, I think when you look at the shocking state of the prison system, one of the things that Inquest is really keen to try and highlight is the fact that, prisons are expensive, they don't work, and I believe that if it were any other setting, they'd have been closed down. But yet we allow the relentless number of deaths to continue, and every week more or less there's a critical inspection report by the prison inspectorate condemning the conditions and regimes that prisoners are being subjected to, and yet we don't see any meaningful change, and we still use prison as a dumping ground for all the kind of social problems that we don't want to actually deal with. We just think that by caging human beings somehow we can put them out of sight, but actually what you're doing is you're reproducing and producing the same kind of problems that resulted in people ending up in the criminal justice system in the first place. And you only need to look at who we imprison. The disproportionate, again, it comes down to disproportionality in terms of people from black and minoritized communities, but also we imprison poor people. It's about poverty and inequality. It's about who ends up sucked into the criminal justice system, very often for want of other services, for want of housing, for want of a job, for want of mental health treatment for addictions.
And that's so clear if you look at those numbers as well, isn't it? And like you say, concealing social problems rather than fixing them. The police violence and kind of excuse it. And like you mentioned, if we're seeing poor people being so disproportionately put away, and black people and people of colour, that if that's the case, in order to stop a kind of outcry, we need to make sure that that is like legitimised. And so it's like, well, these people are more violent, or like you said about people with in mental health crisis, like that they're mad, bad and dangerous. You need to reproduce these things. Otherwise, we'd have to really take a kind of a big look at what the hell this system's doing.
I mean, I think one of the things I'm concerned about is that if you look at the prison system, the focus of government most recently has not been about the unacceptable death toll in our prisons. It's about the problem of drugs within our prison. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't a problem with drugs in prisons. There clearly is. And we know there have been a number of drug-related deaths as a result. But we're not asking questions about why are people using drugs? What is it about the prison system that resorts to people, many of whom may well not have actually been involved in drugs previously, to end up in a situation where drugs are everywhere, where it's becoming a kind of issue for people who have got nothing actually else to do. And the politician's response is focus on drugs, focus on the need for more prison officers and more police officers. And, you know, for me, that's a really misguided approach. We should be much more talking about a social justice approach. The context that we often see the most kind of, I suppose, most arguments around policing is about knife crime, you know, the disturbing number of people who are dying as a result of knife crime. Well, why aren't we talking about the need for youth centres, youth workers, trauma counsellors? You know, talking to people about the impact of a death of somebody close to you.
Yeah.
And the trauma that that then brings to whole communities of people. And yet what we're talking about is more police officers at a time when I think there is real mistrust and a lack of confidence in the police in some of those communities affected, and where, you know, they are victims, and yet the approach is one of not about treating them as victims, but about more law enforcement, which has proven to be spectacularly unsuccessful in dealing with this issue.
I think it is infinitely frustrating that this debate seems to just stay at the level of policing and disorder, you know, despite the hard work of lots of activists, lots of youth workers, community workers who are really trying to build real solutions to these problems. But getting the platforms, getting the resources just seems to be off the table.
I mean, and there's no doubt to me that these things are linked. I mean, you know, we have seen dramatic cuts to community services, mental health services, services for addictions, youth workers, you know, at a time when they've never been more needed.
Yeah.
That's a debate we should be happening. And, you know, mental health's a good example. You know, I fully support the fact that the police should not be the first resort to people in mental health crisis. That's, you know, they are not trained professionals. And yet families are told to ring the police if somebody's in crisis. Yeah. They're not told to ring emergency mental health services. Well, you know, why not? And if there were the political will to do something about it, we could do something about it.
Yeah. I mean, I saw someone, I think it was a police and crime commissioner, actually, who suggested this, that police be issued with overdose kits to treat addicts who are overdosing. Well, we have a national health service. We have drug workers. Well, we have people who are trained in that. It kind of brings us back to our interview with Alex Vitali, the author of The End of Policing, where he threw up this problem of people consistently proposing police as solutions to problems that they cannot solve.
Well, I mean, I've always said, you know, we have access to armed police around the country within minutes, and why can't we have access to emergency mental health services for people in crisis, so that we all as a society can respond to a situation where we feel somebody is vulnerable and needs help by ringing a designated number in the same way that people ring 999. That, to me, is just not rocket science. And if we wanted to do something, if we wanted to have more humane, just responses, we could have them. It's about the political will. And to think outside the box, to think, actually, let's keep law enforcement for what it should be used for, and let's have a more social justice response to a lot of these issues. And I think if we did that, we'd end up having less people caught up in the criminal justice system. We'd have much more trust and confidence in public services, hopefully see an end to what are preventable and needless deaths.
I just want to delve in a little bit further before we move on to our argument ammo section into the way that Inquest works, because I think you're a particularly interesting organisation in that you're one of the only charities I'm aware of that uses a kind of systemic and abolitionist framework. So I want to talk a bit more about how this informs your work and how you go about kind of working in and against the system.
I think the first thing I'd say is, I mean, our model is what we would call an integrated one. So we have an amazing team of really dedicated staff, and we're working on a daily basis with families. And I think that sets the context for all of our work, both the experience of bereaved people, but also, of course, we get an overview of the lives of those who've died. And that has certainly led me and Inquest into adopting a more abolitionist framework. And people, when they hear abolition, are often quite fearful and give you the worst example of a prisoner, you know, that they can think of, and say, well, what you're saying is we should just open the gates and let everybody out. And of course, we're not saying that. What we're talking about is that you need to use prison as a last resort. And I don't believe prisons as they are today can do anything really meaningful around rehabilitation. I think they are failing institutions. If we had a far smaller prison population with properly trained staff and staff who bring in a variety of different skills around kind of more of a social work approach, you could have institutions which were much more therapeutic, healing, and that could actually work to address some of the reasons why people have ended up in prison in the first place. So we could have a much smaller prison population for those who are a real danger to themselves or to society. That is a very small number when you really consider the prison population. And I think we could do much more in looking at the need for alternatives and investment in a lot of the services that very often failed individuals in the first place. But I think we have to work also to try and improve the current system, because, of course, we are concerned with prevention and we're concerned with preventing death. So, you know, we have to draw attention to failing policies on, for example, suicide prevention in prison, and about the lack of training of staff, the lack of involvement in working with families who obviously know their relative better than anybody, and involving them in the system of care that's there. So it's always that tension between kind of trying to get reform but staying true to the view that actually we think that a lot of these institutions are failing and so need to be shut down. And we could, with the billions of pounds that we pump into the criminal justice system, of course, we could devise new and innovative models of working. And I think it's important to kind of have that debate. And a lot of the families that we work with, of course, will say, well, they never understood why their loved one ended up in custody in the first place. And, you know, the criminalisation of mental ill health. So I think for us, I suppose, when you look at our model of working and looking at an abolitionist framework, I think what we're trying to do is get the bigger questions asked around why it is that we are using the kind of places of detention in the way that we are, and, you know, trying to get a debate about whether or not we could be doing things differently. And, you know, there's nothing that focuses the mind, I think, on these issues more than working on a death that you know could have been prevented. And it's difficult to convey in an interview like this the kind of anger and frustration that we see about the fact that the same issues repeat themselves time and again, which is why we have to ask questions about why can't we do things differently. Let's have a more honest debate and discussion about more innovative ways of working, which at the end of the day, to those who call us out for even talking about abolition, well, you know, if we're looking at something like prison, you know, at the end of the day, the majority of people who go into prison come out again. And, you know, for those who advocate prison as go to prison, you know, learn the lessons, come out again, well, I'm sorry that you only need to look at the reconviction rates to see how much prison is failing not only the individuals who end up in prison, but it's failing society. It's failing victims of crime, because most people want, you know, if you're a victim of crime, you don't want anybody else to suffer again, in the same way that our families say they don't want any other family to go through what they're going through. Well, you know, these systems are failing. And some of the very places where you would expect somebody to be safe, like a mental health setting, you know, what is it about those environments that are resulting in people taking their own lives? And it really concerns me. We're doing some work at the moment around, you know, disturbing numbers of young women and children dying in mental health settings. And some of their treatment, their experience of frequent restraint, the lack of therapeutic care for people who've already been identified as being extremely vulnerable, I have to say, is very, very disturbing. And I think, you know, when we're talking about all of these issues, we're talking about institutions, learning disability, we haven't even touched on, but Inquest also works on deaths of people with learning disability, and the fact that they, as a group of people, are prematurely more likely to die. And that raises real concerns about the value ascribed to the lives of certain groups of people, but also, again, about their physical and mental health care. And again, you know, looking at, you know, learning disabled settings. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, an area like mental health settings that doesn't always come onto that kind of agenda when we're talking about prisons and policing. Mm. You know, there are other institutions that contain people and where the way in which individuals are treated really does need the scrutiny that's quite often more likely to be afforded your deaths in involving the police and prison.
I often feel like we could do a whole other podcast series about the way in which punitive systems and cultures function in our public institutions as a whole. But
I think that would, I mean, and it's an area I think that people are far less aware of. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you look at, you know, mental health detention, again, issues of disproportionality, you know, restraint, over medication, you know, what kind of environments are we talking about here? And, you know, in the 21st century, you would really think that we could do better, that we could have therapeutic settings that actually can help people become well.
Mm. Mm. Speaking before of people who are like calling out abolition and being unconvinced by it, I think we should move on to argument ammo.
Let's do it.
To try to convince people. So this is the part of the podcast where we ask questions that might be asked by politicians or the right-wing media or your reactionary uncle round the dinner table at Christmas. Sorry, no need to be that specific.
Sorry, uncles.
Yeah, sorry, uncles out there.
Yeah, not to stereotype a group.
Yeah. The archetype of the uncle. Yeah. This is the sort of part where we're looking for kind of concise and convincing answers where possible. It might be stuff that we've already covered, okay, but it's fine to repeat stuff just so that we can give this ammo to our audience. So Una, you've got the first one, don't you?
So mine actually comes directly from social media. It's interesting that you mentioned the backlash on that earlier, and it came actually from retweeting your tweet. That was a video, an instance of, again, restraint by several police officers in London, I think in Streatham, of a black man. I think he had six officers and he was being restrained in the prone position. It's quite a shocking video. It came out about a week ago, a week and a half ago.
Yes.
And I got a response from someone who said they're an ex-prison officer, and it said, escalation of force is always in the hands of the person who is being detained. And it was interesting because it seemed so logically topsy-turvy to me, but it is something that I've heard kind of coming from lots of people online, and often people who identify themselves as police officers or prison officers, that kind of people who die in police custody only have themselves to blame. And if they'd just done what the officers told them and not run away or not resisted arrest, then the police wouldn't have had to be heavy-handed. So how do you respond to that when that comes up for you?
Well, it comes up a lot. Mm. Concise, short answer. I think it's about asking the police themselves about their propensity to use force as a first resort, not a last resort. We're talking about escalating a situation. Why do the police not more often step back and try and de-escalate? The use of force figures I've mentioned that show that force is being used and it's gone up 79% suggests to me that there is a problem about the police use of force. I think some of the ideas about the, those who die have only got themselves to blame. Well, as somebody who sat through inquest after inquest, looking at the propensity of the police to restrain first and ask questions later really speaks to that issue. And we all recognise the police have got a challenging and difficult job to do, but I think when you're looking at perceptions of certain communities, you know, when the police move into a situation, that video, this the video that you're talking about, I did my best to try and play devil's advocate in tweeting around that. And even if you accept that you have a difficult situation with a crowd forming, a man who doesn't want to be stopped, then look at the use of the CS spray at the end when he's down on the floor and he's clearly being restrained by, I think, six officers. What possible justification can there then be for using that CS spray? And so I think in those situations, I try and talk about the evidence and I try and ask questions about why, if you're a young black man, would you want to run away from the police? Because there are legitimate fears about how people are treated by the police. And it's only if we get greater trust and confidence in the police that I think we can start to have a more rational debate. I think the debate is too often irrational, and knee-jerk responses by the police to things on Twitter don't assist in this discussion.
I think that's really useful to frame them as irrational as well, because they are, obviously. But I think that our frame is often really viewed as such an irrational, like, oh, just look at the facts and you'll see. But actually, yeah, the complete reverse is kind of true. So yeah, our second one, this is taken directly from a comment on an independent article, isn't it?
It is, well, yeah.
where they say, with all due respect, folks, focusing on...
It was just so perfect. I had to take it. Yeah.
Focusing on women when men die at similar rates is nothing short of benevolent sexism, and in brackets, and is therefore wrong. Let's get with the program and enter the 20th century. Hashtag male lives matter, though.
It's a very easy response to this. I mean, inquest works on deaths of men and women, and we have been equally vocal about the disturbing number of deaths of men in prison. However, I think that the system, the prison system, is inherently sexist, actually, and discriminates against women. It imprisons women who themselves have been victims of appalling sexism, racism within society and within the criminal justice system. I also think by focusing on what is a relatively small number of the overall prison population, if we can see fundamental kind of change, positive change, as a direct result of our work towards women, then I would hope that that would then be translated across the prison estate. So, you know, I honestly believe that if we have a more social justice approach and we dramatically reduce the women's population, and we show that that has been, you know, hasn't led to this terrible harm that people seem to think it would do by, you know, opening the prison walls and putting women into housing and employment and to services, then we would argue vehemently, as we do, that this should also extend to the male prison estate. So I think that's just a ridiculous response, actually.
Good answer. Short and snappy. Right? Yeah. Perfect. So we're going to wrap up now.
Okay.
We have a short section at the end that we always do called What Can You Do? So that's helping our listeners with, if they're interested in getting involved in this issue, campaigning or supporting families who have lost a loved one in state custody. What do they do?
Well, the first thing I would ask people to do is come to the UFFC conference, attend the silent march on the Saturday, the 27th of October. Yeah. Please sign up to Inquest's newsletter, to our Twitter and Facebook page, and see how you can support some of the broader campaigning that we're doing, trying to affect change on lots of different levels. I also think that if this is an issue that you don't know that much about, then read more around it, because it's difficult to convey in a short interview just the kind of broad of kind of social justice issues that this raises. But, you know, one of the things I'm very struck by that a lot of families say is that until this happened to us, we didn't realise just how systemic a problem that deaths in custody, deaths in mental health settings are, and also how much these systems of investigation, the systems around inquest need to change and be reformed to better support grieving families. So I think, you know, at the end of the day, any one of us could have somebody we know who could end up in a mental health crisis. And so I think it's an area that I would welcome more people getting involved in. And as I say, we have a website that has lots and lots of information, but also supporting individual family campaigns, because families go through what is a very protracted journey and they need support, and inquests are open public forums. And, you know, it means a lot to families to have people coming along to offer support. So I think there's quite a lot to do. The other thing is that, you know, we elect parliamentarians, and, you know, if this is an issue that has struck you as being one that you think needs more political attention, then use your MP and demand that they actually raise some of these issues, because families and campaigning lawyers and inquest have seen positive changes as a result of campaigning. And I'm, you know, I'm a campaigner at heart, and I think campaigning can make a difference. So get involved.
And what is the inquest Twitter?
At inquest_org. And then the website is www.inquest.org.uk.
We'll tweet out some links to this as well. So all these things will be online as well. But thank you so much, Deborah.
Yeah, thank you.
That was a really amazing overview of the situation.
We'll be back in a fortnight now.
Yeah.
Follow us on Twitter. We're at the Lockdown Pod. And yeah, tell us what you think. Give us some like potential argument ammos for the future. Let us know if you're coming along to the UFFC conference or procession or both. And we'll hopefully see you there.
Yeah. Great. Okay.
See you in a couple of weeks.
Bye.
Bye. This show is brought to you by Navarra Media. To find articles, videos, and more audio content like this, head to navarramedia.com. If you particularly enjoyed this podcast and would encourage others to listen to it, why not head to iTunes and, as well as subscribing, leave us a review. Navarra Media can only exist thanks to our subscribers and supporters. If you have the means, please consider subscribing at support.navarramedia.com. Subscribers will also receive priority access to events as well as promotions throughout the year. For regular updates, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Navarra Media, media for a different politics.